Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As the Labor Day holiday approaches, you may want to consider a visit to Gilcrease Museum this weekend, where the whole family can get up close to some of the amazing artifacts from the Gilcrease collection. The Kravis Discovery Center reopened to the public last month after a major redesign to tell the story of some 2,500 years of American history and culture in an engaging yet 21st century way. Utilizing technology and storytelling, the center tells the stories that help viewers better understand some of the anthropological collections the museum holds, from intricately designed moccasins and clothing to a variety of tools and weapons throughout the years, to breathtaking pottery from the southwestern Pueblos to scrimshaw from the Pacific Northwest. My guest today is one of the project managers for the Kravis Discovery Center renovation, Bob Pickering. Currently a professor of anthropology and director of museum sciences at the University of Tulsa, he's a former associate director at the museum and previously served at museums ranging from the Field Museum in Chicago to the Denver Museum of Nature and Science to the Buffalo Bill Historical Center in Cody, Wyoming. He joins us today to talk about the Kravis Discovery Center and how this latest redesign is mainly a mere stepping point for a further redesign once the $65 million renovation of the museum takes place in a few years. Bob Pickering, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me back.
About a month ago, the Kravis Discovery Center reopened after a major renovation, which really puts technology in the forefront of exploring the Gilcrease collection. What was the impetus for doing this remodel of the Discovery Center?
Good question. I mean, I have to tell you that the old Kravis was one of my favorite places. It's what we call in the museum world sort of an object-rich environment. In fact, you might even call that open storage. Here you have drawers, and in the case of Kravis, there are about 3,500 objects in that room that represent about 10,000 years of human habitation in the Americas. I mean, that's considerable. What I liked about the old iteration of Kravis, which is still there, by the way, is that you can open a drawer and you can literally get nose to nose with these extraordinary objects. And they are truly extraordinary. My background is archaeology and physical anthropology. And I got to be honest, I knew about the Gilcrease Archaeology Collection before I knew about the Gilcrease Art Collection. Mm-hmm. It's as legendary in its own way as the Gilcrease Art Collection is. So here's this great collection of archaeological and ethnographic material. You can look at it in detail. I'm a museum guy. I like dioramas. I like what dioramas do. But in dioramas, you see a scene, you see an interpretation of an activity or an event, but the artifacts themselves are downplayed. Well, in the Kravis, it's the other way around. You can see the detail on objects. And for those of us who have sort of made a life's career of that sort of thing, it's really a huge opportunity that is replicated in very few other places around the country.
One of the things I found interesting was, you know, you say a lot of people will go to a diorama to understand an ancient mm-hmm. culture. In this particular iteration, you'll see the artifact, which helps sort of explore the evidence for creating, okay, this is, we see this object, and from that we extrapolate what actually would happen in a diorama.
Well,
it's the other way around of learning what, you know, that's actually how an anthropologist would learn about a culture. It's like through an object, and then you make suppositions about how that object was used.
You're absolutely right. And herein lies the dilemma in the museum world. Dioramas are wonderful things, but they take years to plan, years to construct. They're really expensive, and then they don't do anything. They're static. So in the 21st century, how do we sort of bridge the gap between the artifact and the understanding of that artifact? Like it or not, we're a digital society. I mean, I'm teaching undergrads this semester, and it dawned on me earlier last week that I have students who did not live in the 20th century, or at least not any significant portion. So the analogies I use, the words I use, the examples I use, I have to be careful because they may not even know what those are. Well, go back 10,000 years, go back 5,000 years. There are objects in the Kravis that not only do contemporary Americans not know what those objects are or have any personal experience with them, they may not have any experience with the behaviors in which those objects were used. How do we overcome that? Well, thanks to 21st century technology, we can do videos, we can do reconstructions, we can do all sorts of things that help put layers of meaning on those artifacts in a way that are movable, that are interactive, and we don't have to rely on static dioramas anymore.
And so I guess when you were redesigning the Kravis Center, mm-hmm. the idea was to, again, keep that focus on the open storage idea where you can just sort of like go through the archives, so to speak, where you have the drawers that has two or three drawers in a row filled with moccasins from every culture, followed by Native American dolls, from a variety of cultures around the world, were just opening a series of drawers. You wanted to keep that experience, but what did you want to change?
You're absolutely right. The best part of the old Kravis was here's all this incredible material that you can look at very closely. The downside is that I'm not a believer in the old adage, the artifacts speak to you. No, they don't. You have to parse the story out. So the idea was, how do we take advantage of the best of the Kravis, which is the installation of 3,500 or so objects down there, and how do we layer on stories that help people understand what they're seeing? And so that was the idea, a very broad idea. How do we go essentially from object to who made this object, who used this object? What was sort of the life trajectory of an object? Now, that's sort of a strange concept, but objects change throughout their life, and then they're discarded, and then other things happen to them. So we wanted to be able to essentially provide context for the objects. We wanted also, and this was a very important point, we wanted to demonstrate the ingenuity, the talent, the artistry of the people who have populated the Americas long before Europeans came here and during the time when Europeans were here. I'm a firm believer that Thomas Gilcrease, in the way he collected art and archaeology and archival documents, he was telling the great American story, and he did that in a very broad way. He included Native American people. So the archaeology collection is as spectacular as the art collection, and if you know how to find your way through the objects, and that's the museum challenge, there are great stories to be told there.
So how does the new Kravis Discovery Center sort of help you find those stories?
Well, let's step back a minute. This is a process. The old Kravis, as you may remember, had the 3,500 objects in drawers, and you pull out the drawers, and you write down a little number, and then you go over to the computer kiosk, and you type that in, and you get a little bit of information on that. You know, at the time that was done, in around 2004, that was pretty innovative. That was pretty technologically oriented. Well, we want the Kravis to continue to be cutting edge. So the museum contracted with Martin Howe, the CEO of Tech4. This is a design firm out of Brighton, England. And Martin has done projects for Disney, for Epcot, for museums all over the world. And his specialty is really doing this, using technology to tell stories. It's not about technology. It's technology as tools to tell stories.
As I was going through the center, I mean, how this manifests itself at the Kravis is when you walk downstairs, when you come down the stairways, the first thing you see is a whole wall full of small notepads, electronic notepads, tablets, if you will. Mm-hmm. And when you think about how we find an esoteric fact, or you're sitting around a lunch table and somebody says, "Wonder what this was." What do? You go to your phone mm-hmm. and you look something up. So the tablet makes perfect sense.
And if you're 9 year old, that's how you think information comes. Now, we may debate whether that's a good or a bad thing, but it doesn't matter. That's how it works. So you go down to the Kravis, you get the tablet. It will ask you if you're there individually in a family or if you're in a group. And depending on the answer to that question, different things happen. If you're in a school group, let's say, of 30 middle schoolers, you will check in as a group. It will immediately divide your class up into thirds. It gives you an animal icon. You can be a jaguar or a bear or a spider. And then those icons will take you through the rest of the exhibit. So it's a way to allow a large group of people to use the entire exhibit at one time, rather than standing in line to do A first and then B and then C. It's not linear in that way.
So you mentioned these three icons, and, and that's for three pods that tell different stories. Tell us about these pods.
The pods do indeed tell different stories. And, you know, the bad news is we had so many stories to tell. The hard part was to figure out what are the ones we're going to do first. And that's really where we are. So with the a bear icon, there's a map table, and it tells the story over an animated map about the natural history of North America to some extent, the resources, the people who lived here, where they moved, how they earned a living, you know, hunting and gathering versus farming versus fishing and other kinds of things. So it's a way to help orient students and people to see this great country and what it would have looked like from a pre-European perspective. So that's really the first stop. And then there are some images of artifacts and objects in that presentation that you will actually then find in the rest of the gallery. So then you go to the second stop, which is essentially about how to use a spear thrower, or in the Aztec word is atlatl, a spear thrower, and there you have some genuine examples of 10,000-year-old projectile points, a banner stone, a replica of an atlatl that an archaeological colleague of mine not only made but knows how to use. He sponsors an atlatl competition every year. So it's about that, but it's also a little bit of physics. How does an atlatl work?
Basically a table that lights up, and it's like a it's not like a TV screen. No. It's almost like a projection.
Actually, it is a transparent TV screen.
Okay,
that's exactly what it is, and it has an animation then of the use of the atlatl of hunting a mammoth. So again, we're connecting the objects to behaviors.
And if people are wondering what an atlatl is, it's basically an extension to your arm.
Right.
And it works on a physics level of basically giving you more force. And it's like a ball thrower that you'll use with a dog.
That's
you
know, what,
you
yeah.
Know. Yes. It's like an extension of your arm, and it causes more force.
It's a simple yet formidable tool that has been reinvented around the world many times. It's a shaft that's so maybe 2.5, 3 feet long. It has a hook on one end to hold the butt of a spear. It has a handle on the other end for your hand. In the middle, there's probably some kind of weight to give it balance. It's a very simple tool, and yet, as you just said, it allows an individual to throw with more accuracy and force over greater distance. It's an advantageous hunting tool. It truly represents the cutting edge of technology, if you will, 5,000 years ago.
Yeah. Also, you have a collection of spear points and arrow points in this kiosk, and you see the actual artifacts, and then all of a sudden there's this projection on top of the artifacts, which show how they were created with the hands sort
flint
of
napping,
flint
yes.
napping. Uh-huh. And it's a very quick demonstration, so it's not like you're watching a video of somebody doing this.
Well,
and, you know, it's just very fast-paced, so I assume.
That's an important point. I mean, you know, in the museum world, obviously we think a lot about objects, but we also think a lot about the visitors, who comes. And we know, for example, if you're going to have a class, you've got basically 55 minutes. There are 30 kids, let's say. There are three kiosks. You've got to get them down there. You've got to do the introductory kinds of things. You've got to give them the tablet. Got to move them along. So that means you've got about 5 to 7 minutes at best for each of the pods. So the question is then, what is the best use of the time you have? Truth be told, and we know this, museums don't make anybody an expert in anything. What we try to do is to show them something that's intriguing, tell them why it's important, and maybe lead them in a direction where they can find more information. And that's really what I think the Kravis tries to do.
Yeah. And the third pod tells the story of various cultural histories.
Well, actually, that's my favorite. It's got different stories told by different storytellers. One of my former students, Danielle Culp, who's Cherokee, tells a traditional Cherokee story. Walter Echohawk, who you may know from other things, he's a very prominent and important and accomplished lawyer, tells a Pawnee traditional story. So we have different voices telling different stories. They're animated. You see the story. You don't just hear the story. They're all under 4 minutes. Again, It might be nice to tell longer stories, but we know from hard data that if we do that, we lose people. So we would rather tell a shorter story and have folks stay there. The other thing to think about in these pods and in the Kravis installation is this is a temporary installation. As you know, the Gilcrease, thanks to the people of Tulsa, have $65 million to renovate and really upgrade the museum. So we're using the current new version of Kravis to test some ideas, test some technologies, some approaches that will be in whatever the new version of not only Kravis, but the Gilcrease is. So this is a testing time.
So you chose three pods to do this. I think if this proves successful in a much larger Discovery Center after the renovation, there might be more stories.
So then there will be more stories from different tribes. That will be stories for different age levels. There will be other interactives for different age levels. One of the things I should say that if you come in a tour group and you get divided up into these little icons, well, part of what you put in is your grade level. And at the end of each of these pod experiences, there is a quiz that's age appropriate to the grade level that you put in. So again, it's a way to get kids to reflect on what they've just seen and heard and done.
Now, if you're wanting just to look at the objects, the tablets also assist with that as well.
Absolutely. You punch in the thing that says you're a family or you're an individual visitor, and then you can really go on your own terms. You can do the same track, if you will, that the students do, but you can also go to the drawers, pull drawers out. You punch in the number of the drawer or the shelf or whatever, and then, boom, all of the objects in that drawer show up. You touch an object, and all of the data about that object comes up. So it's kind of the logical extension of the old kiosk, except then you had to go to the kiosk. Now, essentially, you carry the kiosk on your hand, and it has even more information than the old one did.
My guest today is Bob Pickering, a professor of anthropology at the University of Tulsa, and he is the project manager for the Kravis Discovery Center renovation, which opened about a month and a half ago. It might be a great chance to go back to Gilcrease and see what's new, as this, as he refers to it, the 1.5 version of the Kravis Discovery Center
exactly.
is open,
yeah.
and test this with maybe some grandkids or some kids during the Labor Day weekend, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the things that's really interesting about, you know, you go to these shelves, and what's also interesting is, you know, there are objects that are put away in the shelves, but there are also objects on display on shelving, and there's some of the exquisite examples. I'm thinking of, you know, there's some real eye-catching, just beautiful, beautiful pottery, like by Maria Martinez and from the Acoma.
There are extraordinary things in the Kravis Discovery Center. There are things that you might look at and think, well, gee, isn't that interesting, and then move on. And yet there are things that if you don't see them in Kravis, you won't see them anywhere else. There's a pair of copper ear spools. Now, you know, if you're under 30, getting your ears pierced and gauged, I mean, that's kind of a big deal these days. Well, there's nothing new under the sun. It's been done for a very long time. This particular set of ear spools dates back about 2,000 years. It's from West Central Illinois. It's hand-hammered or cold-hammered copper, and it has silver overlay. To my knowledge, that is a unique pair of ear spools. Mm. They don't exist anyplace else. There are some chipped and polished stone maces from the Spiro site here in Oklahoma. And for those who don't know, Spiro down in southeastern Oklahoma, between about 1150 and 1400, or 1450, I should say, was probably the most important town north of the Valley of Mexico. That's a pretty significant statement. These maces that you will see from Spiro, you will never see, well, there's a drawer of three. You will never see three together anyplace else because they don't exist. They're only at the Kravis Center. So there are extraordinary things. And one of the frustrations of being a museum person is how do we show all of these things and do it for a broad range of people and interests and knowledge levels and all that sort of thing. But, you know, there are really times when you want to grab people by the lapel and say, look at this. This is really special. You're not going to see another one of these for a very long time. And then to tell people, and here's why you should be interested.
Yeah. Now, right now, I assume since this is the 1.5, when you actually click, say, on say, a drawer full of Native American dolls. You'll see the various dolls. You click on it, it'll tell you a little bit of information. But I assume that's something that can change over time, where you're actually maybe telling a story. You get to the spool and you see an archaeologist say, this is a singular object of which, you know, I mean, sort of, you know, sort of this direct communication, the passion that you're talking about, put that on the tablet.
That's what we want to experiment with. You know, I do think it's important to tell layers of stories. I mean, how were those copper ear spools made? First of all, where did they get the copper from? There's no native copper in West Central Illinois. There's certainly no silver in West Central Illinois. Those were trade materials that came into the area. Well, that's the technology part. There's the status and the social part. Who wore them? Mm-hmm. You know, did anybody get a chance to wear these? Well, if there's only one pair, no, probably not. So who was this person and what do we know? One of the challenges of archaeology is sometimes we can't answer the most basic questions, but that doesn't mean we don't try. Yeah. And that we shouldn't try. We do try to do those things. So the idea of recognizing that for every one of those 3,500 objects in the Kravis Center, there are stories to tell, not just one story, but there are layers of stories. And so in this Kravis 1.5, thank you for mentioning that, we're testing the stories that we have, but the idea is to add more stories as time goes on and as we can afford it, so that at some point it's going to be basically a view of North America, North American history and antiquity from the viewpoint of the Kravis Discovery Center. That's kind of exciting. It's a big challenge. It's a big goal. But I have to say, we do live in a technological time where we can do things we could never even have thought about previously.
Yeah. And one of the things, as you see it now, I think this is some of the most new technology I've seen in most museums. And of course, you know, the challenge is to keep up to date with that technology, because, you know, if you go to a museum that had cutting edge technology 10 or 15 years ago, it looks very dated today. What is the process for keeping up with
that? Funny you should mention that. I've had some experience with this over the last 20 years, this whole battle of technology and what do we do. And the one thing I've learned is, don't invest in the hardware, invest in the content. The content is what the museum does best. The curators and the staff and the scholars. And I should also say on Kravis that this was a very collegial project. We had a large number of Native American advisors from numerous tribes. We had archaeologists and anthropologists, historians. You know, no single person has all the stories and all the perspective. And we certainly wanted to make sure that many Native American perspectives were included in this from the get-go. But the idea is to use these technologies to tell stories, but to do it in such a way that, yes, in 3 years, in 5 years, when this technology looks obsolete, we can replace it with whatever is next in line. But we still have the core of the knowledge, of the content, that we can migrate to whatever that new technology is.
You know, one of the things that I found was interesting was that a lot of, when you see a technology in use, a lot of times if it's touchscreens wear out, mm-hmm. and those are very expensive mm-hmm. to fix. It mm-hmm. seems like with the tablets, those are relatively cheap.
They're relatively cheap, and yes, they wear out too, and yes, they can be damaged. But as you noticed over the weekend, each of these tablets has a protective sleeve that goes over it that will mitigate some of the potential damage. But you have to expect, when you have things that are interactive, they're going to break. They're going to go offline for a while. You have to have a system by which those downtimes are as short and as few as possible. Mm. Years ago, back in the 1980s, I was at the Children's Museum in Indianapolis, and for obvious reasons, that the main audience is kids. Well, what's the worst thing you can do in a museum is have interactives that aren't active. They're not working. So we had a system and sort of a protocol. If something broke, and it was not only broke, but it was dangerous, comes off the floor immediately. No questions. Get it off the floor. If it was broke but not dangerous, maybe it could be on for a couple of hours. But the point was, We had backup systems for various levels of technological problems so that we could repair them quickly, and no one ever stood around scratching their heads saying, gee, I think this was the vendor, and oh, maybe in 2 or 3 weeks we can get that replacement part. You can't do that in a museum. That's worthless.
Yeah. Yeah. So my guest today is Bob Pickering, a professor of anthropology at the University of Tulsa, and was one of the project managers for the Kravis Discovery Center renovation, which opened last month. It was, the Kravis Discovery Center at Gilcrease was redesigned and reopened last month using a lot of technology to tell the story of pre-European America and also
the historic period as well. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we want to demonstrate is there really is no break between the ancient past, the historical, and the contemporary. It's all a series of continuous threads. Now, there are various reasons why those threads have been broken sometimes, but you know, we like to think that those stories continue on and they will continue on into the future. And part of the role of the museum is to document those stories and then to present them in engaging ways to today's and future audiences.
Now, you've mentioned several times this is a temporary installation. It's a way of you're going to do program evaluation of how audiences react to the new center. How do you actually evaluate?
Well, funny you should ask that question. One of the other hats I wear is as a director of the master's level museum science and management program, and I'm fortunate to have Dr. Kara Joles, who is an adjunct in our program. He used to be the director of education at the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. Kara is teaching a class this fall on museum education and evaluation. The class project is going to be the evaluation of the Kravis Discovery Center. Now, it's going to be a great experience for students to learn about evaluation, to not just learn about it, but to actually do it in that space, to observe human behavior, to collect data and analyze that data. Now, of course, we're not going to be able to accomplish all of the evaluation in one semester. We can't do that. But we can get started. We can learn about our visitors, and we can help the next generation of museum professionals get some hands-on experience through this program. Mm. So from the very beginning, we talked about how to do evaluation in the Kravis, what needs to be evaluated, and basically it's everything. You evaluate the facility, you evaluate the environment, you evaluate the technology, you evaluate the content, all of those sorts of things. And then to get students involved so they're thinking about this as well for the time they go out to whatever their jobs in museums are going to be, they'll take that with them.
All right. Well, it sounds like a great way to spend the part of your Labor Day weekend is visiting the new Kravis Discovery Center at Gilcrease. Bob, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Bob Pickering is a professor of anthropology and project manager for the Kravis Discovery Center renovation at Gilcrease Museum, which is open during regular museum hours. Visit gilcrease.org for more information. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.